Pour something flammable in your glass. It's Gator Gamer Cast. My name is Lang. Nathan is away at the Cool Man You're Not Expo, so joining me again is freaking guest host Maddie. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, what's up, everybody?
Hey, what's going on?
I'm here, ready for some solid dick.
Ready for that solid dick. I'm going to take my hat off, because fuck it. And then Maddie, since we are in your brand new condo.
That's right, yes. I'm supplying the alcohol tonight.
That's right, and it's 5 minutes away from my house, which is fantastic. Perfect. I'm very happy about that. But yeah, so I'm drinking some sort of child's concoction of brisk lemonade and sweet tarts vodka. It's actually really good. So I told him to throw that bartending magic at me.
And that's what I came up with, like literally the seven things I have in my house right now.
Perfect. It's delicious. And Matt, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking Bud Light Lime because that's what I bought to supply everybody with when you guys helped me move.
Perfect. And I actually drank a few of them, so hey,
it was a hot day on Saturday.
I think that's what made it palatable in that moment, because the last time that I had it, when you brought it over, it always tastes like ass to me, but it was really hot, and it was a really cold beer, so it just, like, anything was perfect in that moment, so I was like, you know what, I have no problem.
I just feel like Bud Light Lime is the best when it's a really hot day and it's really cold.
I think that's all, yeah, exactly. Right? Like, a lot of people drink Coronas, and they're like, I don't see what's so great about Coronas. And then there's a cool Corona, and then they're just like, that's all I drink now is Corona.
There's nothing great about Corona, or memorable about Corona, besides that you always drink it on vacation. Mm-hmm. It is literally, they have done the best job marketing to you, this is what you drink on vacation. You're like, I don't even like Corona, but I drink it on vacation, and I don't know why, because that's what I need, and it needs to have a lime, and there needs to be a beach.
And as we're talking, so we are going to go straight into This Week in Hobby. We're going to talk about a book that you and I both read, so it's going to be a little bit of a longer This Week in Hobby. But you wanted to talk about the joys and the strife of being a hobby addict who now has to move all of his hobby shit. So, what was your plan going into this? Because you have an entire room now full of models.
We will actually take a photo of this room.
We'll post that photo, yeah, for sure.
Post it on the Facebook group. You kind of just tell yourself that you're going to box things up and go through it when it gets to your new place, right?
Yeah.
And then you box things up and you box things up and then you box things up. And then you realize you have a problem. And then you bring it to your new condo. And you fill up an entire room full of fucking modeling crap. And you decide that you're like, really, I really need a Bis Bazaar to happen sometime soon. Or that I have way too much stuff and there's going to be a lot of stuff flooding like Facebook soon. Which I think is great. The one thing I noticed about this is that it definitely shows me how much I do have and how much of it I have never even looked at in like years.
Well, yeah, like you had an entire bin of just unopened Star Trek Attack Wing models.
Literally an entire bin.
Yeah, just an entire bin of just unopened Attack Wing models.
There has to be at least like over $400 of Attack Wing models.
Easily. Yeah, I mean, easily. You didn't pay retail on enough of them, so it wasn't like it was the end of the world. But yeah, easily enough. Yeah.
No, so I think...
Don't throw up on the microphone. Jesus.
I'm burping. I'm burping Bud Light Lime.
Drinking Bud Light Lime.
And it's not hot or cold right now. I think the biggest thing is there's going to be a lot of stuff that, you know how hard it is for you to cut the cord on things that you've had for so long, and like, it's part of the routine for having this stuff. And then
it's yours, right? You put the time into it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things is going to be that, like, when you're moving, this is the easiest time to cut the cord on stuff that you've had for a long time or held on to, and you just need to say, I don't need it anymore. I need to put it online. I need to sell it.
Yeah.
Because once you have everything in front of you, you see how much you have. It's really easy to be like, no, I haven't actually touched this in 2-3 years. I don't love the game. I don't love this game anymore.
What are the chances?
Why do I have a case of Heavy Gear stuff?
Well, I think Heavy Gear we did as an act of friendship to another person.
I love my Heavy Gear stuff.
I still look forward to eventually maybe playing it.
But yeah, like, so I look at like Attack.
Not quite a Closet of Shame, but I think it did show up at the Closet of Shame.
But I definitely think that, yeah, there's going to be a lot of 40K stuff that'll be going through. There's going to be a lot of, like, my Star Trek Attack Wing I'm just going to start flooding the market with.
Well,
and it's more, and luckily we have a Bis Bazaar coming up, thank God.
Yeah.
I think I have three cases, like three bins full of old codexes that I've been lugging around for like two moves.
I think
now.
I sold three or four Army books and codexes in the last Bits Bazaar, but I still have a pile of them that I have nothing to do with.
Yeah, so it just goes to show that you need to, like, when you have a move like this and you're moving to a new place and you do get all your stuff in one area, the best thing to do is really inventory it, go through it, and really make hard decisions on what you're actually going to keep.
Okay, so your advice to people who are moving and who are hobby addicts who have a lot of stuff hanging yes. around is that while you are packing, you should be in that decision-making process of what am I keeping, what am I cutting the cord yeah. on? Because for you, we had that whole conversation about the closet of shame a long time ago. You can't actually fit all of the stuff you don't use anymore into a closet. Because your closet is full of hockey jerseys.
And shoes.
And shoes. So, I mean, you literally have a spare bedroom and it is just full of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, for me, when I moved, it wasn't that big of a deal because I think I was still working at Games Workshop and a lot of my stuff just ended up being there. So while I did cut the cord on a bunch of stuff just before I moved, I ended up selling a bunch of it. Mm-hmm. I was moving into a larger house, right? Yeah. So it was like, I knew I would have a full basement to put all of that stuff into. So I actually never was in that situation of thinking to myself, oh man, I gotta start cutting some ties here. I really gotta start making some choices. I was still in the mode of just like, fuck it, it's the golden age, 40K will never die. You know, like, for me, that was the big part of it. So, all right, so for you, we moved everything in, we unpacked everything, it's all sitting in the room now. Like, what do you think when you're staring at that room full of stuff?
Man, I've done a pretty good job in the last, like, 10 years just yeah. acquiring a ton of stuff. And I think I sold, like, 13 40K tanks last year, too. It made a good coin off them. And I still yeah. have boxes and boxes and boxes of just stuff.
Like, well, you had a bin of drop pods.
I do have a bin of drop pods still.
Correct.
I don't think I'll ever get rid of those because I do actually love my drop pods.
Because fuck that. I love drop pods.
If I ever come back to playing 40K, if I ever come back to playing 40K again, I'm fucking running drop pods.
No, Matt, you were the one who were unpacking and you're like, man, I gotta get rid of that fucking Space Hulk. I'm like, why did you buy Space Hulk in the first place? You're like, Blood Angel Terminators in it, just in case I get back into fantasy, but that, or get back into 40K, but that's never gonna happen. But now, with drop pods, you're like, well, it might happen.
Fuck, you're right. I do need to get rid of these drop pods,
man.
I do love those drop pods, they're amazing.
Everybody loves drop pods. So yeah, I mean, that is what you did this week. That was yeah. primarily, did you do anything else, any hobby related stuff?
Actually tonight when I was moving my last stuff, I dropped my Hawker fleet onto the ground.
Oh, perfect.
Oh, I was so fucking choked.
Did you find all of the stupid
I don't know. Like, I dropped it onto like a thing out, like to a staircase outside that was wood. So they fell into like the middle of the wood and I was using a knife to pick them out. Oh, I was like, it was like one of the last boxes I moved, and I was so fucking choked.
You'll never ever do that Hawker fleet. I want you to know that. That Hawker fleet will never be completed.
Oh my god, it is cursed. It is so cursed.
That's monstrous. Yeah, so for me, I was primarily working this week. I did a fair amount of work on my Aquans. So I've been starting on my next two squads. I've got the base layering down on all of my tier 3.
Okay.
So once I'm able to go through all of my tier 3, I think I should be able to get through them pretty quickly. I'm going to start working on my tier 2, and I'm actually going to finish it off with the battleship. So the one completed model that I had was my assault carrier.
Okay.
So now, like, I'm going to finish with the battleship. Like, that's going to yeah. be the final thing that I do.
The fun one.
Well, not only just the fun one, but I've noticed that a lot of times with Firestorm, because it's not an enormous amount of models, but you still want to get them done quick, I tend to leave my centerpiece model for last. And then since I'm no longer, like I know the lights at the end of the tunnel, I feel like I kind of take my time a little bit. That like, oh my god, this is going to take forever, like, yeah. panic attack is gone now.
I think for me, the way I paint my Firestorm stuff when I'm doing a fleet, I'll do tier 2s, tier 3s, tier 1s. Because the good thing about breaking through cruisers is you can kind of like tweak your, you can kind of tweak the highlighting and how you do them as you go along.
Yeah.
And kind of finalize what you're doing. And then the tier 3s are so easy. Once you have like the kind of like the colors down, tier 3s, you bang them out in like a night.
Yeah.
Like, because you're really comfortable with doing all the colors at that point. And then, yes, you're a big showpiece model. You can do last and it's fun mm-hmm. to do and you put the extra time into it and you make it beautiful.
Yeah,
or exactly. Space Bubble. Because I know for my Hawker fleet, if I actually do finish it one day, the last things I'm doing are the battleships.
Yeah, well, if you have all the pieces.
If I have, oh my god, I I can't. Oh my god. I'm gonna have to like contact Spartan and see if they can send me like another pack of like fins.
So the other This Week in Hobby thing we're gonna take some time to talk about is Matt and I both just finished Pharos.
So spoiler alert
from the Horus Heresy. So this is gonna be a bit of a spoiler alert here for anybody who is currently reading the Horus Heresy. Now this is three books back, I think, from current. There's an anthology which I just started, Eye of Terra, which I thought was a funny play on words. And then there's another one after that, which has come out as well.
Which was the big thick one called? Is the big thick one All Is War or War Torn? Is it the big anthology book? Was that before Pharos?
I think that was before Pharos.
Because I just cracked that one up.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I've actually read that one. I can't remember. All the anthologies tend to blur together when you're trying to like catch up on the short stories.
The big thing about the anthologies is that like when I kind of like with the anthologies, the only things I kind of looked through all the anthologies on Forge on Black Library before, and I kind of just pick out the Blindgel stories. So I've read Virtue of the Sons, and I've read Sins of the Fathers, and there's a new one that just came out. But those are all in the anthologies, right? So I think I've bought the anthologies after, but I have those ones in it. But I kind of picked out the Blindgel ones before.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we're going to talk about Pharos a little bit. We're not going to give too much away because, I mean, obviously, if you've read any of the 40K series or the Horus Heresy series, there's not a lot of big bombs that get dropped for the most part.
Yeah.
It tends to be a lot of, like, little revelations that come around.
Lots of Easter eggs.
Yeah, Easter eggs are definitely in this one, which is what I liked. We'll kind of talk about that in a bit. But, this is not breaking the theme. This is not breaking the story, the Horus Heresy story that we all know and love. There are no huge, massive revelations in this, you know, like the big ones from fucking, what was it?
Vengeful Spirit?
No, Eisenhorn.
Okay.
Yeah. Where the one dude says, I'm Alfarious, and everyone was like, ah! And everyone lost their shit, because they're like, is it Alfarious? Is it his brother? Is it just fucking some Alpha Legion guy, right?
We don't know.
So it's nothing like that. There's no spoilers in there like that. Well, we're not going to talk about that kind of stuff. But what I really want to talk about, and this is what I want to get to, is that it has been a dry spell for 40K books being good. Mm-hmm. Like, if I keep going back, there's been a lot of mediocre ones and a lot of bad ones.
It's because there's been a lot of Salamander ones.
Well, Salamanders and White Scars, neither of those were particularly good.
No, I thought the last White Scar, where he fought Matorian, but I thought that was a weird fight because they were on the Thousand Suns homeworld, so that one felt kind of really shoehorned.
It was an exceptionally weird fight, yes.
But I enjoyed that book.
I want to say I enjoyed it, but I don't want to say I enjoyed it.
I didn't hate the White Scars in that one, which is saying a lot, because the White Scars are a pretty dumb chakotay. Jakati Khan is the guy who decided when he's while behind the walls of Terra that he's going to ride his bike out to a fucking starport. Okay,
like, well, we don't know how that's going to play out yet. Okay, so take it easy, man. Take it easy.
I've never seen them in very good light.
But, yeah, I'm going to bring up a list because I can't remember all the bits and pieces in between. I kind of want to go back to like the last book that I felt was genuinely good. So Silent War is not out yet.
No.
Path to Heaven.
Is another fucking...
Another White Scars book.
So,
Eye of Terra, and then Pharos. Before that was...
War Without End is the one I'm talking about.
That's the anthology. So, Deathfire, Legathes of Betrayal was another one. Damnation of Pythos was just terrible.
Vengeful Spirit was amazing.
Vengeful Spirit was pretty good.
I love Vengeful Spirit.
It's been a while, because Vengeful Spirit was released in... It doesn't say. So, yeah. But the fact that we actually got a really, really good book, and a really good book not from, like, the King 3 authors, right? Graham McNeil or ADB or Dan Abnett, right? But, like, having this come out from a new author that
this was fairly untested. Yeah, this was, like, his first Horus Heresy book.
I believe it was his first Horus Heresy book. I'm actually going to see if I can fucking see what his name is, because I don't remember it.
Well, leading up into this book, the one thing that really this book helps is that it's a follow-up to Unremembered Empire. And Unremembered Empire is kind of a follow-up to Unremembered Empire,
because it doesn't have actually anything to do with Calth.
Exactly. Yes and no, because Unremembered Empire is not Calth. Unremembered Empire is the one where the Dark Angels come out of the sky over Ultramar, and then the curse comes down and fights Vulcan.
Yeah, but that all takes place on McCrag.
Yeah, and Unremembered Empire.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was thinking of... Mark of Calf.
Yeah, you're thinking.
Sorry, Mark of Calf. I was thinking Mark of Calf.
That's why this is.
Yes,
this
Unremembered Empire was really good, and that was Dan Abnett doing his thing.
And this is a This is literally the follow up to Unremembered Empire. After
yes,
really seeing.
Yes, absolutely, it is.
After seeing Imperium Secundus really in
Secundus,
we're seeing Imperium Secundus really in the heyday of what their actually plan was.
Well, what they're trying to do is building a new Imperium, right?
Yeah.
So what I love about it was, yeah, it was really good. And it had all of the hallmarks of a great Horus Heresy book, being that Space Marines were interesting enough that you could remember their names.
Yep.
That seems to be the benchmark now, because if you were to ask me what any of the names of the White Scars from those books are, or what any of the names of the fucking Salamanders were from that fucking book, like, there's no way I could remember any of those names.
The one big Ultramarine in this one, who's in the, I think he's in the Alpha Company, or whatever company is in that strike team that comes to the planet.
Yeah.
His name's Koraz.
Corvus.
Corvus, yes. And he's actually really interesting. He's a really fucking cool character.
Yeah, well, like, they have enough characters and they have enough story branching out, but one of the things I loved about this book was that they tied in a lot of human elements to it. It wasn't just a bunch of Space Marines with one human going, hey, humanity exists, and then all the Space Marines sitting there philosophizing at each other.
Yeah.
There was actually an ongoing story thread, and that ongoing story thread was about what was essentially like a reserve force, like a planetary reserve force of like all the farmers who had lived on the planet.
Yeah.
So it was their year to be part of the reserve when the Night Lords attack the planet. So by the title, you can figure out that this is about the Pharaohs. Mm-hmm. So if you read
Unremembered Empire.
Unremembered Empire.
And I believe it's in one of the short stories before that, too.
Yes. So if you read those books, you know that the Pharaohs is some alien mountain beacon that is being used to light things up through the warp storm that's currently still ravaging the galaxy and stopping interstellar travel and communication.
And the Pharaohs is also used to communicate through the 500.
Yeah, so you can communicate through this like weird holographic interface, but the holographic interface also kind of works as a teleportation interface, which is very cool. So the Night Lords don't really know what it is and what they're going for. And I mean, I don't want to get into like the core parts of the story because it's not important to just talking about how awesome the book is, but it's interesting. So that was one of the things I want to talk about, was that the actual plot to this book was actually an interesting plot. Like, I remember back when I was reading way, way, way back in some of the later books, I think it was the second Aaron Densky, Bowden, oh God, what was it called?
Word Bearers.
So it's the second Word Bearers book Fulgrim is with them.
It's not,
and he's trying to suck out.
It's not the traitor one. First Heretic. It's the one after First Heretic.
I think it's the one after First
Heretic. Is that Aurelian?
Aurelian.
I thought it was pronounced Aurelian.
I thought it was Aurelian.
Oh, really?
Well, it's pronounced Aurelian in the audiobooks,
I just always pronounce it as Aurelian. I've always pronounced what's his fuckface's second name is Aurelian. It's Aurelian?
It's Aurelian.
Okay.
Aurelian. So I believe it was
First Heretic.
Prospero Burns or First Heretic. Yeah, it's probably First Heretic.
Yeah.
But yeah, the story was all about how Fulgrim... Or wait, no, that was the Thousand Suns book. God, fuck. They've all blurred together, apparently. Jesus Christ. Well, this is a great book review. But no, I really did like this actually had a really good story. Because if I go back to other books... Anyways, this does prove my point. They tend to not have as good of a story.
Yeah.
They're just like... I can go back to Mark of Kalth, or I can go back to Unremembered Empire. I can go back to these where it's just like, oh, big shit happened. I remember all of it.
I remember First Heretic because it's one of the best books that they've ever.
Yeah, it wasn't First Heretic. It was the second Thousand Suns one.
Okay, that's
or the second Emperor's Children one.
No, that's Angel Exterminatus.
Yes,
that's Angel Exterminatus because he's with
the Blood Angels were around.
And he's with the fucking Iron Hands.
Perturabo.
Perturabo, yeah. And he, like, pretty much fucks him
up. Iron Father Pro Turbo.
I really liked this book for the simple fact that there's a ton of Easter eggs, but the Night Lords in this one don't seem comically bad. They don't seem like Saturday morning villains.
I don't feel like they were ever comically bad.
And some of those ones where they fight the one short story where they're fighting the Dark Angels and fucking Lionel Johnson murders his own fucking crew members. The Night Lords in that one are as badly written as the Dark Angels. Maybe it's just a badly written book at that point.
It could just be a bad short story, man.
but that's the one where Lionel Johnson's murdering his own like subordinates, and then Night Hunter's like laughing cackically, and then like all the Night Lords are just incompetent. Like it's just a bad book.
So let's talk about incompetent Space Marines, because there is a trend where. What will happen is the bad guys always tend to lose and the good guys always fight harder than the bad guys do, right?
Yeah.
And this book was no different, to be perfectly honest with you. It was absolutely no different. And I think that is one of the things that bugged me. But I actually thought that they handled the Night Lords a lot better, and I actually was very interested in the Night Lords because the Night Lords came off very Dark Eldar-ish in this book, where they were just, everything was torture and everything was like skin wrapped over this. Like, they genuinely feel like the first chapter to go full fucking chaos.
In that
chaos sense is like as we know them now. One of the bits where they describe like, and then the one guy had fucking bat wings on his helmet. Yeah. And you're like, oh, that's where it started. You know, like kind of cool stuff.
And they've always been known as terror troops, and they literally take terror to the upteenth level. They're the ones flaying people.
Yeah,
they're fucking putting people on crosses. And the interesting stuff is that even
like how they're wearing LCD screens with like live torture.
And they're one of the biggest chapters that like they were always comically bad and like they're kind of like mustache twirlers. But this one, like the guy who's like the big bad guy in this one, he's actually not supremely competent, but he's not an idiot either. And he seems to do a pretty good job of like getting people fired up to fight for him. And like every time the Night Lords are in combat, they're getting gunned down by like everybody. But they are supremely scary. Everything that they always do, people show up and they see the Night Lords and they're like, holy fucking shit, the Night Lords are here.
Well, and I think that what made them really stand out was the fact that this book also had that human element, like I talked about before, where you have that Imperial Guard reserves unit that's fighting against the Night Lords and dealing with this invasion. And the fact that the invasion was 20,000 Night Lords versus 100 Ultramarines and a bunch of Imperial Guard.
I like the idea that when the Night Lords first took that scout ship,
I thought that was really cool,
the guy who planned it supremely outsmarted the Ultramarines in their own game because they knew exactly what the Ultramarines had to do. And I like that part where every time someone beats the Ultramarines, they're doing it because they know their doctrine. And they use it against them, right?
Oh, don't worry. They'll follow the codex.
Yeah, because it's the codex. And that's one of the best things about when you're fighting Ultramarines is when someone is just like, yeah, they can't. That's what they have to do. They're predictable.
Yeah.
And their predictability is what's their fault.
And I thought that was very cool because the Night Lords didn't come off as punk-ass bitches in this one. And they really did stand out as being a very cool chapter with their own awesome traits. The fact that they focused in on the two twin brothers, or not twin brothers, but the two brothers. I don't want to get into that because I think that's a very cool story.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in general, like they added a lot of character to a chapter that is typically given very, very little little character to begin with. It's always just like, I'm a scary space marine.
There's a Night Lord that deals with a demon in this one, and I love the ending. About how the demon pretty much fucks him over at the end.
Well, all demons fuck everyone. But he thought
he was smart about it the entire time until the ending. And the ending's a great twist, so I'm not going to ruin it.
Oh no, it's fantastic. But I think outside of that, the other thing that I think stood out for me with this book is that we got a lot more Primarchs being interesting and having interesting relationships because the books that fail in the Horus Heresy series are the books that fuck up the Primarchs and make them uninteresting, right? Like, as much as I love Graham McNeil, Fulgrim was not a particularly great book for me because I could not enjoy Fulgrim, and I had such a hard time with him dealing with the other Primarchs.
I love The Emperor's Children, and every depiction of Fulgrim has made me just want to smash my face through a window more often.
Until he becomes like a demon.
Yeah.
Like a demon prince. Like, until that happens, you're always just like, oh, fuck this guy.
And even in Angels of Sermonatus, before he became a demon prince, he was insufferable.
And then 100%.
And then he sucks, like, Perturbo's soul out, and he's like,
well, he tries. tries to sap him dry, and then Perturbo goes driving off into the sunset. But I really, really liked, and I won't get into it because I don't want to, again, I don't want to spoil too much for everybody who's getting into it, but there is an amazing conversation between Conrad Kurz and Sanguinius, and it is a direct follow-up from Unremembered Empire, and that conversation is really, really cool. Because that whole conversation is very informative. It gives you a lot of information about Conrad Kurz. Whereas up until that point, Conrad Kurz is just this like person. Wild dog, crazy motherfucker who just is like unbeatable and nobody can fucking touch him. You know, you've got the fucking lion and the avenging sun going at him 2-on-1 and they're
getting owned.
Oh, they're getting the shit kicked out of him.
And the thing is there's a bunch of times where Rabut Guliman is talking to Sanguinius, and the two conversations they have with each other is very interesting, because Rabut is, he backs himself into a corner, and he can't do anything about it now.
Well, and yeah, I think, again, they're putting, what this book does really, really well is it continues the story, and it keeps pushing the story in a very specific direction. And it's a direction that makes you go, okay, I'm interested, I'm buying in, whole ham, I want to see what happens next, I want to see what's going to happen. So yeah, if you guys have been maybe a little burnt out on the Horus Heresy books, they're not really doing a whole lot for you right now, I absolutely recommend that you read Pharos. It's the best one I've read in a long time.
It's interesting to say that if you ever hear someone be like, yeah, you know what would be interesting? Sanguinius and Rabut Guliman talking, and you're like, oh my god, do we need the two most pimped out Primarchs talking? Like how's this gonna be interesting?
This is gonna be talking about Blaine.
Exactly. But no, this book is amazing for all the conversations between the Primarchs. They have great interactions. The Night Lords are actually interesting.
Yes.
The Alterines in this book are actually interesting.
And then the interaction between the Imperial Fist and the Iron Warrior is really, really cool. Yeah. And they're the same two characters from Unremembered Empire as well. So, like, it being that continuation and playing those characters in that direction is really cool. It's really worthwhile.
And the Easter eggs at the end of... Literally in the last five pages...
Yeah, there's like four or five good Easter eggs in the last five pages.
Where, like, I saw it lying on Saturday, and I was like, did you get them? I was like, because it's like, awesome.
Yeah, I got it. I got it, man. It's really fucking cool. No, they did. There was a lot of cool little Easter eggs for the actual 40K years as opposed to the 30K years, which is just fun stuff for people that are reading it. And again, I have to give a lot of credit to the author for being very, very skilled in... not only just knowing the lore and kind of knowing what's there, but also kind of knowing what fans are going to pick up on and what they're going to enjoy. Because, yeah, he hit it out of the park.
I had to read the epilogue in this book three times to figure out what actually happened. Because I read it once and I didn't take it seriously, and then I read it again and I was kind of like, are they going there? And then I read it again and I'm like, holy fuck, they went there. And I was like, that's great.
All right, so let's move on to the weekly listener poll. The question that we had for you guys was... do you enjoy these sorts of long, something shiny segments from time to time? And with a resounding positive vote, smashing the naysayers, 89% of you said yes, you do indeed enjoy the long, something shinies. Hey, now, Matt, how did you vote on this?
I voted yes, of course, because, you know, a podcast where I enjoy hearing you talk, I would enjoy to hear you talk more. Like, it just seems like a pretty loaded question at that point.
Fair enough. So there's a couple of very, very long comments on here between some people who are talking about not necessarily the poll.
Perfect.
Which is great. So those guys had their conversation. I'm going to basically say that they got like, look how fucking long that post is.
That is a wall of...
That is a blog. So I'm going to move on to the actual first comment here. So the Jersey General said, personally, I love the extended something shinies. I'm not into Doctor Who at all, but my friends are. Your coverage of it let me actually talk to them about it a little. Plus, it's fun hearing your take on other aspects of nerd culture outside of gaming. I'm pretty jaded too, so it's nice to hear opinions similar to my own, presented in a fun and entertaining way. Absolutely toss us an extended something shiny when you have something good to cover. And that's always kind of the way that we've looked at it, is that something shiny does always kind of come up at the end of the episodes, but sometimes it's 5 minutes, sometimes it's 10 minutes. And it was one of those things where... we had been doing the podcast for, I think, 2 years. Two or two and a half years, maybe even three, before we actually decided to do something shiny. And part of that was just because we'd been talking about Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000 so much. And we'd gone through all of the Codex reviews. And we'd gone through all... yeah, like, It was just we had done so much at that point that we felt like, man, we just kind of want to talk about
stuff,
other stuff that's not necessarily tabletop game related. And that's always been the Something Shiny segment. And like pop culture being what it is now, I mean, there's entire podcasts, many, many, many podcasts that are just pop culture YouTube, discussion podcasts.
YouTube channels just cover news about pop culture week in and week out.
Right, and it's just,
and it's insane.
Like, one of the things I'm noticing now on a regular basis is just, like, you see a lot of really established YouTubers and YouTube channels, which is, like, multiple content creators on the same channel, and the videos that they post are Batman v Superman, was it good?
Yeah.
And, like, they're kind of more of a video game channel. It's like, and so I kind of look at that and I'm just like, really? Like, why do you guys feel like you need to weigh in on this?
Well, I think it's like if you ever watch, like, ESPN and watch, like, Hot Take, it's like people just, or, like, how, like, the entire morning of ESPN is, like, Hot Take show after Hot Take show after Hot Take show. And it's like people who don't even have any business making opinions on those things, people just want to hear those people's opinions on anything. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fair, and I think we all kind of fall into that hook. Like, I love hearing Kevin Smith's opinion on virtually everything.
Yeah.
Because Kevin Smith has a very funny opinion and great insight,
and,
right?
And I've really become a really big fan of John Schnepp. I really enjoy John Schnepp's take on everything. Or Max Landis. I like
Max Landis.
He's a great Twitter follow. Because he's so opinionated on everything, and his stuff makes sense. I don't agree with him half the time.
No.
But he makes sense.
I think if you're following anybody who is essentially like a talking head, right, like an opinion, like a pundit, right?
Uh-huh.
But a pop culture pundit, trademark. Like, you should never agree with them 100% of the time, because if that's what it is, then it's basically
you're a fanboy.
That is essentially it. Yes, I really like Max Landis. I disagreed with him 100% about Star Wars: The Force Awakens, but I agree with him 100% about Batman v Superman. I love, you know, like you were saying that you saw he had a tweet about Captain America
Civil War,
which we'll talk about at the end very likely.
Yep.
You know, like what he had said about it, you're just like, yeah, I totally agree with that. I was like, I said it when the movie was over. That was basically what it came down
to. Max Landis tweeted this week. He said, be so great at something today that Max Landis calls you a Mary Sue. And I was like,
that's funny.
I was like, I want that on a shirt or like a poster, like an inspirational quote.
Perfect. Richie says, yeah, keep them coming. I sure as fuck don't listen to you guys for news and rumors. Bring on the jaded bitching. Thank you.
Perfect. Someone who gets it.
That is exactly what we're looking for there. So yeah, interestingly enough, that is exactly what it is for us. Why did my camera turn on? I don't know. Let's close that there. So yeah, thanks to everyone who voted on the weekly listener poll. You can find those on jadedgamercast.com. We will have another question for you at the end of the show, of course, if we remember. So let's move on to the main topic of today's show. We didn't do Model of the Week. Let's do the Model of the Week.
Yes.
We're going to do Model of the Week now. Model of the Week is this crazy-ass fucking wizard that somebody posted. It's fucking crazy.
And Darvey? And
yeah, Jordan Scott posted this one.
And Derver?
And Ver.
And Ver. See, my pronunciation
is terrible. I know. You are actually the worst. It's Rabute. And Ver. Bibbidi bubbidi boobla boobla da. So this guy was posted to the Jaded Gamercast Facebook group by Jordan Scott, and he said, hey, this is a great model of the week. I happen to agree. This is fucking cracked out Van Art Gandalf. Right? Like, yeah. He's got a Harry fucking Potter wand. Like, it's either Gandalf or Dumbledore, depending on which theme or lore you want to go with. But I think he's leaning more toward Gandalf. And it's a night. I think it's a well modeled.
I think
it's a well sculpted model.
Just the paint job is MDMA Gandalf.
And for those listeners who don't know what that acronym means,
I don't know what MDMA means. Just MDMA is MDMA.
Okay, moving on. So MDMA Gandalf. I mean, good on you, Matt. Sorry, I didn't know that calling you on that would be such a big deal.
I don't know the acronyms for drugs.
Fucking Google it, man.
I don't know the acronyms for drugs.
So, yeah, it's a drug, everybody. I think it's a really interesting model. I think it is modeled actually really well. I think that there's a lot of people out there who would look at a model like this and go, dude, that model's fucking sweet. But I think anytime you put a model together that is badass old man, you're only going to hit about 30% of the market with it, because a lot of people are just going to go, so is it just ecstasy?
Yeah, no, it's ecstasy. No. MDMA is the core drug for ecstasy. You create ecstasy from MDMA because ecstasy is cut with something else.
So like meth.
It's like meth. But like ecstasy is cut from MDMA.
There's kids listening, Matt. We don't need a tip on how to brew this shit at home. I just wanted to know what the acronym was.
It's
too long. It's a chemical. Matt has a hard time pronouncing names with seven letters in it. So we're not going to make him read it.
But I can tell you how ecstasy is made. The core thing is MDMA. All
right. Well, you know what? Start a blog and a blog. Pick that up. But for now,
I've been to a few raves.
Model of the week. Okay. Like I was saying, anytime you make a badass old man model, you're only going to hit about 30% of the market. Because I think a lot of people
are
going to
be compared to Gandalf and or Dumbledore.
That's exactly what I'm saying, right? Like, it's just, this is a model that is not going to stand out other than the fact that, yes, it is modeled, like, it's sculpted well. And, like, it does nothing for me. It's not a model I would ever buy. So I look at something like this and I go, okay, this is either going to tell me one thing or another thing. So the thing it's going to tell me is, first, it's going to tell me that this is something somebody did, or some modeling company did online, and they said, hey, look at this cool model, and then they put it up there. Or this is a model that is part of a range in a game, and that this has given me a really good idea of the level of quality that game is going to bring to the table.
Well, what I like about this model is, besides the color choice, is not that good. I like the sculpting of the hair. It's not on fire, so he's not a flaming hobo. I like the details of the feathers. I like the floating rocks, actually. I think the floating rocks is a cool detail.
Yeah.
So you can do a lot, if you're a really skilled painter, if you're a really skilled painter, you can do a lot of stuff with that kind of detailing. I like the wand. I like his pose, actually. Like, his pose is very you shall not pass, but I think it works.
But it looks like he's mid-dance.
Yeah, he's...
You shall not pass!
Also going with the MDMA.
That was basically what I was aiming at.
But
we all drop E, and then he's just blowing in the wind, man.
But it's a very good sculpt, lots of detail. It hits all the great marks. I'd like to see a 360. I'd like to see the back of him just to see what the pose actually looks like from behind. I'd like to see how the cape works out, how it's blowing up. But I just want to see a different paint job because I don't like light blue and purple color.
Yeah, but those are very, like, typical magic-type colors, right? Yeah. Like that
ethereal
blue and that sort of, like, chaos-y purple. It's a common color theme.
I guess I'm just used to being depictions lately of wizards just being very solid one color. Like, Gandalf the Grey is gray. Gandalf the White is white. Dumbledore's
gray. Tell me more. What about Saruman? What color is he?
He's black.
Oh, my God.
Best...
You dropped. Never mind.
From Warhammer Fantasy, like when we saw the college magics, like they were predominantly
colleges of magic.
They're predominantly their colors, right?
Right, but this would be like the Celestial College would be these colors.
I thought Celestial was more white, though.
No.
In Fantasy,
I don't believe so. Celestial was like the colors of space. It was like a space backdrop, like one of those fucking vinyl mats from Gale Force 9. Like that was their color scheme.
Okay, fair enough.
I believe so. But anyways, for the most part, I agree with you. I think it's a really cool model. The colors, I don't have a problem with. I actually think the colors work quite well. I just think it's the fact that if this is going to be a showcase model for you, this obviously is coming from a Kickstarter because it's got the little add-on at the bottom right. So if this is from a game, this is a great showpiece to say, listen, guys, look at the level of quality we're putting in this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a nice model. Like you said, I think the rocks are the absolute neatest touch. I would not be surprised if we start seeing a lot of companies like Games Workshop and other modeling companies copy that.
Yeah. Right.
At 100% copy that shit because that is not something you've seen before.
No.
And it is a super cool thing to add to a model to give it a lot of depth. And like I think that detail on this model makes it stand out.
Well, I mean, it makes you like...
It pops.
It makes you have that wet dream of being like, yes, sooner my models will look like Dragon Ball Z characters. And I can make him Super Saiyan. And I can have rocks around him. It's cool things like that, right? And people have been trying to do that, adding that to their models for a long time. But you just can't do it. But being able to model it on that, awesome, great. So yeah, whoever did the digital or the green cutout of that model did a great job.
They really did do a phenomenal job on it. All right, so we're going to move on to a kind of quick main topic of today's show, since we did a little book review earlier today. And this is just something that we felt like we wanted to talk about. We just kind of knew that it wasn't going to take up an enormous amount of time. So we saw the release of the Syndicate models for Firestorm Armada coming from Spartan Games. What was interesting about this is that we've actually known the rules for these models ever since they released the Marauder rules for Firestorm Armada over a year ago. And when they released those new models, it wasn't really anything to write home about. You know, like, the rules for Syndicate have always been kind of middle of the road, where their battleship is the star player and everything else is kind of garbage. And the big thing, though, is that they're a gorgeous fleet. No fleet looks like Syndicate. Syndicate is the baller-ass rapper fleet. Like, they are super slick. These are essentially space mobsters who have all of the credits in the world. They're so rich that they've essentially decided that they're going to build their own fleets.
Yeah,
they're fucking starships
they're
like Cadillacs.
Yeah,
like,
they're space Cadillacs, space yeah. Bentleys. Like, they are the prime. And ever since we got... we've been playing this for a long time now. I remember when the Spur was first teased, and they were just like the Syndicate, and it was one ship, and
it was
there was a heavy cruiser at the time, and you could take and only take it as one. It was one
squad
ship.
Of one.
It was a squad of one heavy cruiser, so it was a terrible choice. Syndicate have always been a terrible choice. It's never been great to think. But man, did that ship sell, because
looked
so good.
I think Imaginary Wars was constantly sold out of it. Like, it was so hard to get that ship because, yeah, everybody wanted it. It was fucking, like, just such a cool-looking fucking ship.
Yeah.
But the problem with it has always been that you can't really do an entire Syndicate fleet. And that meant that the best you could ever do was take a Syndicate battleship in with your other stuff.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people tend to not like to do, because people generally lean towards synergy and symmetry when it comes to a lot of those types of things. So even though it's cool to have that model, it's super fun. So we wanted to talk about, since they've released two different patrol boxes, essentially. Well, not...
They have a battleship box and a patrol box.
Which, yeah, you're going to buy both of. Because basically buying one of each is what's going to give you an 800-point fleet.
Or you can be like me and already have two Syndicate battleships and a Syndicate heavy cruiser.
You remember how we talked about earlier how you have a problem?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't need I need the patrol fleet.
Yes.
But I don't need, because I'm going to take two battleships, of course, because they're so nice.
Well, and here's what's strange to me about the design of these boxes. So before we actually talk about the Syndicate and whether or not they're worth it, or how you would actually play them if you wanted to play them as a full fleet by themselves, when we look at these boxes, this is the first patrol fleet that we're seeing that is actually one ship short, being that it only has two gunships with it, I believe. And you don't get a battleship. You get the solitary battle cruiser.
The always been weird positioned Spur.
Yeah.
It is synonymous with just being like an underpowered, weirdly positioned. Like, you can have a heavy cruiser squadron of one, or you can have a really underpowered battle cruiser. Because battle cruisers are not that good in this game. Let's be honest about it. They've always been like weird tier. They've always been weird tier one choices.
They're definitely not bad. They're maybe not the most optimal, but they are definitely not bad. So the weird thing about this, again, talking about the boxes, is that with the patrol fleet being what it is, you would look at that and you would say to yourself, like, okay, well, I'm obviously going to need a patrol fleet because I need tier 3, I need tier 2. So with that, I'm going to get the two gunships. They're going to act as my tier 2. After that, I'm going to pick up the battleship group, which is a battleship and another 5 of their frigates. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to give me my two tier 3, my tier 2, and my tier 1s, with an additional tier 1 being the battle cruiser.
Yeah.
Like I said, what's strange about this is that, to me, it seemed as though this was an opportunity for them to actually put together a fleet that made sense, that was maybe a little bit more similar to the existing fleets. And the only reason why I say that is not because I don't like things being different, or I don't like fleets working differently in their smaller forms. The reason why I say that is because the way that this is set up now, you're not really getting enough.
No.
Right? Like, you're not really getting...
Well, but you don't even have... Well, this release doesn't even have a cruiser box, where you just scroll down, the Zalokians have a frigate box,
yeah,
a patrol fleet,
exactly,
a dreadnought box, and a cruiser group box. They're a full fucking fleet. The Syndicate is just like some weird, like, it's a weird release. I love the Syndicate. I'm going to buy it. I think I've said that about every release Spartan has ever released, but yeah. You know.
No,
it's true. I love the Syndicate. I think they look great. Yeah, these boxes are kind of weird. I'm lucky enough to already have a battleship, like two battleships, so I don't need
the patrol box. But this is what I'm getting at, though. What I'm getting at is
the construction.
Why, after everything that you've done up until this point, after the initial Syndicate release and after their whole like weird like squad size of one battle cruiser, why would you not take this moment to actually... Like, why wouldn't you take this moment to actually make this squad a squad of two, like every other fucking battlecruiser in the game? Because then I could look at this battlecruiser and go, oh, fuck yeah. Hell yes, I want two of these. This is a great choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that they're still saying, well, it's just going to be one battlecruiser. Well, it's a tier one with six hull points. You know, like, that's kind of carrier levels, but you don't really have the support that carriers have, you know?
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem with it is I kind of look at this and I still say, well, yeah, I'm going to have that Syndicate patrol fleet, but that Syndicate patrol fleet's not... I'm not happy about that.
Can the gunship squadron be two to three, or is it just two?
It's just two.
It's...
And we're going to talk about that when we talk about the actual list building, is that a lot of this stuff hasn't changed. Now... The thing that makes me think that it's not going to change is the fact that those boxes use the existing squad sizes.
Yeah.
All right. So the new models. Yeah, they're nice. They look like the Syndicate. They're actually not as nice as the last of the other Syndicate models, like the Battlecruiser
and
the Battleship.
I really like the frigates.
But they're sleeker.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting if you think about it from the perspective of The tier one are where all the mobsters are living, so like those are the most like glorious ones.
Yeah.
And then all the tier two and the tier three are like their hired thugs and their guns that are just there specifically to protect them. So they're much sleeker, much more dangerous looking. I think if you keep that in mind, the fleet's actually really fucking cool looking.
I just really liked the gunships are fine. The gunships didn't blow me away, but I really like the frigates because I really like the idea of them looking like bullets with like little wings. Or like really quick, like smaller cars, like just you know what I'm talking about, right?
I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
They're like
bullets with wings, or you know, like smaller cars.
Like
fuck are you talking about, man? Like a Pinto?
No, like, I'm thinking from like a big ass fucking like old school caddy to like a small ATS.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's the difference between. You know, like a stretch limousine and
Cadillac.
Like a Honda,
yeah.
Right? Like
no, but they're both still Cadillacs, right? But you said having the big seat.
So one's an Escalade,
yeah, and one's like an ATS.
Sure, okay, all right, I see what you're saying then. Holy shit, man! All right, gotcha. Yeah, I think that again. I think that the aesthetic of the fleet is actually really cool. So with that being said, when you talk about a fleet that has a really cool aesthetic. The very next thing you want to talk about is, can I play this fleet? Will this fleet be competitive? How do I build it? So, here's the thing to remember. If you guys go all the way back to when Nathan and I did our first review of the Marauders book, you will remember that we actually didn't have a lot of great things to say about Syndicate. Syndicate is part of the STL, which is the Syndicate and Traitors League.
Which is Terran side.
Traitors are terrible.
They are.
Traitors don't really have much of anything that makes them worth taking. So for a lot of the stuff that the traitors do, like I've never even seen a person with a traitor fleet ever. I've never seen it on the table. So keep that in mind. You're basically just playing Syndicate with the way that this thing is set up. The battleship is good, right? So that is the thing you need to keep in mind because you do not have a dreadnought. You do not have heavy cruisers. You do not have a lot of the things that your typical core fleets are going to use to push through the majority of games, right? So everything that you're doing is based on the battleship. So, Matt, do you think it's fair to say that every fleet should start with two battleships being built?
Yes. Every fleet should start with definitely two battleships, and every fleet should go with two wing capacity and quick launch.
Yes.
Your battleships are able to launch 18-inch bomber wings with quick launch. Or whatever the command is. The command is on these things might be 8. I don't know if they're 6
well,
or 8 on
the big the big thing to remember, and you passed it. The big thing to remember, it's right underneath the battleship. The big thing to remember here is that with a wing capacity of 4, plus 2 wings gives you a... It basically makes the battleship a carrier.
Yeah.
And if you know a whole lot about Firestorm Armada, there are very few battleships that also act as carriers.
And the Ralthosa is the only one.
Yeah, Ralthosa, I think you can also do it with Omnidyne and Aquas.
Yeah.
So there are very, very few that actually do that. So having something with the firepower of a battleship that also has the punch coming from a carrier means that this is a high-end tier one choice. Mm-hmm. And it is
turn limit 1.
DR7, CR10. Movement 6, so this thing is very slow. Yep. But again, it's a fucking limo, dude. Yep. What do you want?
8 hit points.
Yep, 8 hull points. Crew point 6, AP 4, point defense 6, and no mines. But you've got 2 shields, 4 wings, and a turn limit of 1. Turn limit of 1 on a battleship is spectacular.
Yep.
The majority of tier 1s have a turn limit of 2. That is typically considered the standard, or usually considered the minimum.
Yeah.
Having a turn limit of 1 on a tier 1 is very, very rare.
And I'll say this now. You already have 2 shields. I think taking the 15-point shield upgrade on this ship is a trap. You need to take it as the carrier. You have to take quick launch. Quick launch bombers are fucking amazing, especially with this. So the extra 6-inch range, it makes your battleship have so much range coming out. And the good thing about quick launch is you can change your direction about where the bombers are going. So
hit them in the rear.
You have a greater range of always hitting someone in the rear with your bombers. A strength 6 bomber wave to someone's rear all the time is just devastating.
Oh yeah, it does a lot of damage. Not to mention the fact that you also have Dirty Secrets and Elite Crew.
Dirty Secrets is fucking amazing. It's so good.
Dirty Secrets is fantastic, and Elite Crew on everything in your fleet is also really great.
The great thing about Dirty Secrets is if you ever played RSN, take the Dreadnought because the Dirty Secrets on the Dreadnought is so good, and it's such a great counter to whatever someone's doing. If someone actually is making their attack card seem very important, you can just make that attack card not useful that turn, and it's awesome.
Yeah. So you have the option of taking 2 Shadow Class frigates in along with as escorts to your battleship. This is a decent choice considering the fact that they are turret based, primary weapon turret based. And your battleship has a primary weapon turret. So it is nice to get that little extra firepower to go with it. But in general, the firepower coming out of this ship is pretty damn solid for a tier 1 battleship. It's a little bit less than what you would normally see for tier 1. But it is actually higher than what you would normally see for tier 1s who have turrets, right? So if we look at like Terrans, or we look at a couple other fleets that have turrets on their tier 1, like I think Hawker also has it. Actually, this isn't bad. This is actually a good combination of firepower,
well,
right?
If you combine
the turrets with the gun racks, it's a lot of damage.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so you're having kind of like the director problem where you can only shoot out of one arc, but you can make that one arc super devastating. The gun racks for this ship and a turret are coming out, pumping out 15 out the side of primary range band. You're still getting 9 out the front with the beams in the 4. So you're able to really be pretty scary. So if you're in your tight range band of being within 16, within 20 of pretty much 2 or 3 targets with the bombers, because you have quick launch.
Yep.
You're going to be doing great damage at a range band too. Pretty much everything.
So if you've never played a fleet that is built on 2 battleships as your core big hitting damage dealer, you have to understand that battleships are always going to feel slightly underpowered against dreadnoughts, slightly underpowered against really, really tough heavy cruiser squadrons and things of that nature. That is going to happen. You cannot get away from it. But because you do not have the option to take a carrier, both of these have to act as carriers. Both of them have to screen. Both of them have to go in and try to hit as hard as possible, as fast as possible. Because your movement is really slow, it's going to be a bit of a problem for you. But if you just kind of keep trucking your way forward, you should be able to get in there, and you should be able to get in and do your
damage. If you're ever running 2 battleships as the center of your fleet, get ready to do some pack hunting, because you're gonna either run them as a tandem or you're gonna shunt them both in.
Yeah.
Don't even care about your fucking admiral. Just shunt them both in and just be a pain in the ass, or run them as a pack in the middle of the field and just do field control. Because if someone's coming, someone's not gonna worry about staring down one battleship. But if you have 2 battleships with wing support and they have great turrets, so they're able to pretty much put their firepower where they need to all the time, people are not going to be trucking headfirst into 2 battleships thinking, are feeling pretty good about themselves. Well, unless they're bringing a lot of firepower to bear, like a dreadnought, a heavy cruiser squadron, a frigate squadron.
Like, a frigate squadron, ooh.
Well, some of the flank, right?
Well, I agree with that to an extent, but I don't really, because I think when we talk about the next two options is where maybe that concept, that plan changes. So we've got the battle cruiser, the Spur-class battle cruiser. And as Matt said, it's strange. It doesn't really make sense. It was originally a heavy cruiser. Now it's a battle cruiser. It still has a squadron size of one.
It has never not been a squadron of one.
And it is only 40 points cheaper than the battleship. So for 40 points, you're losing two hull points. You're losing one crit rating. You gain an additional point in movement. But yeah, you're losing point defense. You're losing a shield. You're losing wings. You're losing firepower. Like, this is a nerfed version of the battleship for 40 points less. That is just, it feels like they took 100 points off of it.
You take the wing upgrade and run six more bomber wings. That's all you do. And you shunt it in. That's all it's good for.
Well, if you take the wing upgrade, it is essentially a smaller, version of a carrier.
It's a pocket carrier.
But honestly, I think with at six hull points with one shield, that's where it starts feeling really, really soft to me. Mm-hmm. I would much rather lean toward the battleships. And because these are so similar in terms of their role, the battleship is always going to win out. Because let's be perfectly honest right now, you're going to have extra points left over.
Well, if I ever build I built a 1,200 point syndicate fleet one time where I ran my admiral on the battlecruiser, and I shunted both the battleships in, and then I ran the tac car that lets me reroll shunting on the second turn.
Well,
and just literally run my battlecruiser away from everything.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad you brought up tac cards, because we're going to talk about tac cards at the end, because I think tac cards are kind of the ace in the hole for a lot of any of the mercenary fleets. So let's talk about the gunship. We've got the Wraith-class gunship. It can be taken in a squad of one or two. This is your only tier two option. DR5, CR7, movement 7, 5 hull points, 4 crew points, 3 AP assault points, 5 point defense, which is more than the battle cruiser, which is interesting. Again, 0 mines. You get 1 shield, which is the same as the battle cruiser. No wings on this, but you have the option of essentially taking a decent amount of fixed forward firepower. So like a lot of gunships, what you're getting out of this is a big chunk of firepower kind of coming in out of nowhere. I personally like the shield upgrade on these, giving them 2 shields apiece and just making them 100 points flat.
Yeah.
Because you're not taking a squad of 3, do it. Like, you absolutely want
to
do that.
I think if you get to 16 at the in the 4 with the turret, I'm pretty sure if I do quick math here, it's 16 and 9 is 25. 25 halved goes to 12. 12 plus 9 is 21.
That's a big money firepower.
So if you're able to run one squadron of these and someone gets into the wrong spot of you, you're doing great firepower. You're losing your beam upgrade, but who cares at that point?
Well, and that's the big part of it, is because the turrets are primary and the forward weapon is beam, you're suffering the problem that the directorate tier ones suffer, which is you have this sweet spot of between 16 and 20.
Yeah,
you know, or not 16
and 12.
Yeah, 16 and 12. You have the sweet spot between 16
and 10
that you have to hit it in. So there's this little 6-inch sweet spot that you have to hit in order to get this big firepower. Now, the nice thing about this is the way that this is organized, anything in between is not that big of a nerf. So you're not actually losing an enormous amount of dice by being in the wrong range bands, which doesn't really bother me all that much. But no, I actually think that these are half decent. They're not amazing.
2 shields.
But they're only good for dropping in behind with a folding space deployment. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, you can't put everything in folding space, which is why your battleships are likely going to have to stay on the table.
The syndicate are the, we should just shunt the whole entire fleet, because that's what you want to do.
So that's kind of where the gunships land. I think you are going to want to take 3... Well, okay, what's the limit for gunship squads? I'm interested now.
And just max, and just take, like, if you take 3, so take 600 points of gunship squads?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm going at. So tier 2 at the battle fleet level, you can have up to 2 squads. So yeah, you're going to max out at 2 squads of gunships. Unfortunately, that's the most you can do.
That's a good 400 point investment, though. Why not? Like it's solid.
It absolutely is. But this is where we actually start talking about whether or not you can actually fit an entire fleet, battle-sized fleet, 1,200 points worth of shit, using the maxes for all of these things, yeah. Right? Max you can take is two battleships. The max you can take is two gunship squads. So you're going to end up having to take the Spurs, right? Like, it's very strange in that way because you only have so much to work with. Even if you get your hands on a shit ton of the Tier 3...
Because, like, the frigates are only 1 to 3.
The frigates are 1 to 3, and they're only squad size... Yeah, is that what you meant, 1 to 3? Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. So I'm going to go back up here and see how many actual frigate squads
they're only 70. They're only 75
points. Yeah, so at a battle fleet size, so 1,200 points, you can only take 3 frigate squads.
So you can have 9.
So maxed, that's how much you can take. Like, that's not going to add up to 1,200 points right there.
What's an accompaniment on your battleships there?
So here's the thing. You're going to be playing this as a patrol fleet unless you're going to be mixing other things in here in order to supplement what's missing.
I'm taking a 1,200 point fleet.
Okay.
I'm doing it. I'm going to max everything out.
Good for you. You can take 3 tier 1, which means you can take 2 battleships.
And the Spur.
And a battle cruiser, yes, correct. I mean, good for you. Good for you, Matt. The frigates themselves are not all that interesting. They're pretty decent little frigates. It's a squad of 3. It's very typical. They have primary turrets, which is fun. They're not great. They're okay.
It's such a handicap only having a squad of 3. Ask in Reddy players how that works out for them sometimes.
The majority of my squads are squads of 3, unfortunately, yeah. With the fleets that I play, so. Except for my Omnidyne. Squads of 6. Squads I love 6. It. So, with all that in mind, Matt.
12. Not bad.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's
12
not...
12 firepower coming with the front for 3 ships at 75 points isn't bad, but yeah.
It's terrible.
It's something you want to shunt in.
So, here's the problem with the fleet. With everything that you're given right now, with all the stuff since we've gone back and we reviewed everything that's there, Syndicate, do they work?
Not really. They don't... They're a weird fleet. They're definitely not super competitive. You're playing them because the models are really nice.
You're playing them because they're fucking cool.
Yeah, and honestly, like if I ever do my Syndicate fleet, which I probably will, if I win like 2 games with these crappy things, I'll be pretty fucking stoked. But, and you're banking on wings and shunting, and that's the weirdest part. And your game breaking tac cards. God, these Marauder tac cards are so good sometimes.
That was going to be my thing. If you want to play Syndicate, play them at 800. At 800 points, they actually are pretty decent.
Well, they are
relatively competitive because of that exact reason. Because of the fact that you're not going to have to deal with a lot of heavy cruisers. Because of the fact that you're not going to have to deal with a dreadnought. They are very competitive at 800 points in my mind. And the reason why they're competitive at 800 points is because of those tac cards. The Marauder TAC cards with Bug Out and Virus Strike being the two primary ones that you're going to use in every single game, those two TAC cards are amazing, and they can win you games, and they can really tilt these fleets over the edge and actually make them worth taking. At the Battle Fleet, God, if even you maxed out on every single choice, I don't even know if you'd actually be able to make 1,200 doing that, but... To be perfectly honest with you, like, they're not good at the Battlefleet level. Do not play them at Battlefleet level. I think the max you could get away with playing these guys at would be 1,000 points, and that would still be Battlefleet. That would still mean that they're going to bring dreadnoughts at you, and you're going to end up getting fucking destroyed. But I think at 800 points, they are a really competitive choice. I think if you focus on that 800-point level, they're actually a really cool fleet. I think that they work well at 800 points, and they... A lot of their holes, like a lot of their strategic holes, kind of don't really matter quite so much at 800 points. Mm. You know what I mean? Because they are a blunt force trauma type fleet. Because,
yeah, at 800, you can take the battleship, you can take the Spur, you can shunt the Spur in, and you can still run a squadron of gunships and max your frigates out. And I think that puts you pretty close to 800 points. Which would be a pretty good fleet, actually, because then you have the Spur being able to shunt in, run those wings, and you have your battleship being able to hold the middle, and your gunships can get in there and kind of get their shots in when they need to. The frigates, 2 or 3 squads of those guys being able to pump up 12 firepower, that's really good firepower for 3 ships. So that kind of stuff is great.
Don't throw up on the microphone, Matt.
Oh, man, Bud Light Lime, so good.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, just the best. I honestly, I'm kind of excited to play these guys now. I've always loved the aesthetic. I've always wanted to paint them. I actually wanted to go to, like, a Cadillac dealership and, like, Cadillac pearlescent white paint and just, like, just put that on, the, just, like, straight. And just be like, yeah, they're painted Cadillac white. Like, that pearlescent white Cadillac. Oh, so nice. I don't even care.
Classy.
I don't even care. And then, yeah, and then the attack cards are very good. I would run, because they're so good at shunting, run the two, Virus Strike, the Bug Out, and run the shunts, the reroll your shunt rolls one.
You don't reroll, you just get out.
No. I'm talking about the one on the second.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're saying.
Yeah, just that one.
Reinforcements.
Reinforcement. Just the reinforcement card. Run that one in the two in the Virus Strike and the Bug Out. You can run your battleship into the middle of the fray, pretty much never worrying about it actually ever being killed, especially at 800 points.
So with everything, I'm just doing this up right now just so we can actually see it. And even with the Battlecruiser squad, I'll go ahead and add the accompaniments as well. Just to get us up there. wing capacity. That's what we were saying. Wing capacity. There you go. And I'm not maxing them. I'm just taking what I would normally take. 900 is what you would end up with, max everything.
So battlecruiser with accompaniments, battleships with
accompaniments. Well, if I add accompaniments to everything, I might have 1,000 points.
Nice.
That's what I was saying, man. I'm like, I don't even think it can make 1,200. If you literally take everything they give you, it is impossible to play it at 1,200.
We're trying here, okay?
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying, right?
Ally and Terran Defender.
This is the thing people need to know if they're looking at Syndicate going, that's my fleet, man. That's what I'm doing. First, you get the fucking coke, then you get the fucking power, then you get the fucking women. That's a bad quote. But, so, there you have it.
Scarface of you.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. There you have it. I mean, that's the Syndicate. They're a super cool fleet. They've got a really cool aesthetic. Their rules are not amazing. There is nothing special about them. They just have kind of an interesting combination of beams and turrets.
Yeah.
And that's all you're really getting away with it. And the fact that their battleships and their battlecruiser are essentially all carriers. You've got cool stuff there. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying they're shit. I'm just saying, at 800 points, I think that they actually, that blunt force trauma style of gameplay works. And you can totally play that and do well at 800. But do not build for more than that. Because I think when I built that up to 900 points with the spur, I would just drop the fucking spur and be like, perfect, I'm happy at 800 here. Two squads of gunships, three squads of frigates, and two battleships with no accompaniments. Done, man. I'm fucking happy with that. That's a decent fleet. So yeah, that would be the way that I feel about it. All right. So hey, Matt, something shiny.
Hey.
We went and saw Captain America: Civil War. So, hey, guess what, everybody? Spoilers again.
Spoiler alert.
If you don't want to hear... Well, okay. This we're not going to do super spoilerific, right?
Okay.
Let's just talk about the movie for the people. So, no spoilers. Let's say no spoilers.
Soft spoilers.
Soft spoilers. Yes, correct. For those of you that don't know, Spider-Man is in the movie. We'll talk about that a little bit. All right, so... You listened to Nathan's review of when we were talking about Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
Doge.
Doge of J.
Yeah. BBS Doge, as they say on the streets. And, I mean, obviously that movie was divisive. Obviously that movie had a lot of problems, a lot of faults.
Yeah.
And we had really, really low expectations going into that movie, and it still destroyed our low expectations and made them even lower. However, we went into Captain America Civil War with really, really high expectations.
My expectations were too high.
Way too high. Listen, this is the fault of the reviewers, like the professional reviewers who got to see the movie like 2 weeks before it launched, where they're saying it's the best fucking superhero movie ever made, and it breaks all the molds, and it's a knockout on every level, and like... I mean, they really hyped the shit out of this movie, and they overhyped it.
They pumped it. I think it was.
It is good, though.
It is very good.
It's very good.
It's a very good movie. It definitely hits home on all cylinders. I wasn't disappointed seeing it. I was just ready for it to be better than X-Men Days of Future Past, which is my pinnacle.
That is my pinnacle of comic movies.
That's
top shelf.
I don't read comic books. I read those two comic books.
Yep.
I grew up loving the X-Men TV show, and the best arc X-Men TV show did in the 90s with the cartoon was Days of Future Past.
Well, don't worry. That movie's going to get ruined by Apocalypse.
I know. All the momentum we've built, it's going to come crashing down in those 3 weeks. I can't wait for Ivan Ooze to ruin my franchise again. And, you know, so, but whatever. We'll talk about that one in a couple weeks.
All right. So, Captain America Civil War. Let's talk about what we didn't like first, because I think that that's the easiest thing to talk about.
Yep.
So I'll start it off. This is what I said as soon as the movie ended. I turned to you guys and I was just like, it was good, but I felt like that movie needed another 20 minutes. And it's the longest movie to date from Marvel, so it's two and a half hours.
Yeah.
But when the movie ended, I didn't feel like there was a lot of closure to the movie. Considering that this is the third movie in a trilogy, you kind of want that closure. Like, are we going to get a fourth Captain America movie? I doubt it.
Well, Infinity War is technically the fucking...
Well...
Infinity War is just
the... It's the fourth all of the movies,
the
right?
The culmination of everything, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I get that. I felt the same way, too. That it just... It didn't... After... The characters went through a lot to kind of end up in the same places.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The fact that they really didn't go anywhere. Even though the character development in there was really cool. Because we actually got to see a lot of characters come back. We got to see a little bit of extra development for all of them. The interactions between the Vision and Wanda.
Yep.
Was really, really cool. Really cool. Like, you get a lot of stuff from the Vision's perspective. You get a lot of stuff about, like, how he views the world and how his consciousness works and stuff like that, which is really awesome. I really, really liked the Spider-Man section of the movie.
Oh,
it's the best Spider-Man movie to date.
The two parts Spider-Man's in are amazing. Tom Holland fucking nails it.
Yeah, he was really strong.
I
loved fuckable Aunt May. I thought that was very entertaining.
I love though she was just a plot device for being hot.
Oh, dude, I love it. Stark. Fuckable Aunt May was the one that threw me for a loop. I was like, oh shit, they went, oh wow, okay, I'm ready for this. I'm ready for this next Spider-Man.
And like Tony Stark even called it out. He's like, oh, is she single?
Your grandmother is surprisingly attractive. This is kind of throwing me for a loop here. No, listen, like, genuinely... The movie is very good, but it does leave a little bit to be desired at the end in the sense that you feel like there should be 20 more minutes of closure. The movie kind of ends and doesn't end on like a whimper. It just kind of it gets to a point where you're like, right. Oh, okay, so what's next? And then nothing's next.
And you're like, huh? Oh, all right.
Yeah, the movie just kind of ends.
The
other problem that I had with the movie was that the villain is very inconsequential in this movie.
He's a plot device.
He is a plot device. He's a good plot device. He's done well. But if you were hoping for Baron Zemo from the comic book, it is not Baron Zemo from the comic book in any way, shape, or form other than the fact that they share a name. And with that, all of your expectations for Baron Zemo should be dispelled. And you should go into this movie.
He's definitely not wearing like a purple fucking biker mask.
Like a balaclava, right? Like... Yeah, he doesn't have a fucking toque pulled down over his fucking head. So, that's really what it comes down to, is that the villain is very lackluster. Now, in a movie called Captain America Civil War, where it's all about superheroes fighting each other, maybe that is to be expected. However, the best Marvel movies are the ones with good villains.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always been the best thing. Like, all the movies where Loki's in them are fucking great. No matter what you say about Thor, you don't like Thor movies, Loki's always good. He's a fan favorite. You can't say anything bad about him. That's one of the big things there. But this villain just does not play at all. Okay, so let's talk about the things that we liked about
him. I still have one thing.
Fire away.
Just the depiction of Captain America. Soft spoilery. It's just, for being a Captain America fan, and I am a huge Captain America fan from the... For his depiction in the MCU, I didn't read a lot of his comics. I didn't even read the original.
Don't worry, he's a pompous asshole.
So my depiction of Captain America is from the 1990s Spider-Man TV show and his depiction in the MCU. For everything you see in that, it's just there's a bunch of questionable. And even Max Linus said this again on Twitter. He's like, just like the Captain America depicted in this is just he's just the questionable choices just don't make any sense.
For no, they the, listen. Captain America's team is Team Friendship. Yeah. Everything they do is about friendship and that's it. Yeah. Like that is, and then Team Tony Stark is Team Logic, and like that that is where you're always going to run into a problem. Now I will say this. Captain America, yes, he made some very strange choices, but I understood them, and that's what I liked about the movie. I was worried, and you were obviously worried as well, because in the comic books, if you ever disagree with Captain America, you're turned into a fucking Hitler.
Yeah, my question for you is, how many babies is Tony Stark going to punch in this movie?
Right, and I was like, at least five, because he disagrees with Captain America. In the comic books, if you ever if any character disagrees with Captain America, writers just instantly start writing them like Hitler. It happened in the previous Civil War. It happened to Scott Summers. Like, just don't get me started on that shit. But I love Captain America in the MCU. What this movie did really well is that both sides were understandable. Yeah. There you didn't have one side that was pure evil. You didn't have one side that was just so off base. You were like, well, clearly that person's wrong, which is a very brave thing to do in a movie called fucking Captain America, right? Yeah. Like this is the Captain America movie, and they didn't just turn Tony Stark into Hitler.
Yeah.
Both sides were very, very good, to the point where my wife and I went in on Team Stark. You went in on Team Rogers.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, you had switched to Team Stark, and my wife had switched to Team Rogers.
Yeah.
Now, when I went to work, the two girls that I work with were Team Rogers going in, Team Rogers going out. So when I actually had a logical conversation with them about all the dumb fucking decisions he makes, they're like, no. And I'm like, what about all the laws he broke? And they're like, he's exempt. I'm like, fuck you guys. Dude, fuck you. Just because your fucking Stucky fan fiction didn't happen, you're all fucking pissed off.
No, but my biggest... yeah, that was my biggest problem with the movie. And I'm not saying that the depiction of Captain America in the movie is bad. It's just that... for how he's been depicted in the MCU and that and his values, it was a very weird turn for the character. And I'm not saying it was a bad turn. I'm just saying I didn't feel personally, and this is my personal opinion, I didn't really like the direction he went. Period. It just didn't pan out well for me.
I'll talk about it. I don't want to spoiler it, so I'll talk to you about it afterwards.
Okay.
But I have an interesting thing to point out that I kind of realized after watching the movie. One of the other things I really liked was that all of the reasons why they're fighting make sense. It escalates in an appropriate manner where it starts out a little soft and it just kind of starts getting a little bit more brutal until by the end of the movie, that shit is on.
Yeah.
And when that shit is on, it is on. The other thing I loved about the movie is the movie actually pulled a fast one on me. When they kind of hint at something a couple of times in the movie and you don't really put the pieces together, I think particularly keen minds will put the pieces together. But when they put the pieces together for me at the end of the movie, I was like, oh, shit, that's what that was? Fuck. And then you have to watch it?
Yeah.
Like, no, that was so good.
The first time I saw that part of the movie was in the first 5 minutes. I knew I was going to turn to you and say it, and I didn't, because I didn't want to say it in the middle of the theater and root it for like everybody around me.
Because you talk really loud in theaters.
Because I was literally going to turn to you and be like, yeah, that. And you were going to be like, shut up. And I would have probably ruined it for like 20 people.
Yeah, no, and that was the thing is like, I brought it up in previous conversations that we'd had before the movie where I was like, this is going to happen, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
So I had even said it was going to happen, but they had done it in such a clever way that it actually caught me by surprise, which I was really happy about. And like I said, the fights between the heroes escalates to the point where, like, when it's on, it's fucking on. And it is done well. Those fights in this movie are the best superhero fights
ever. The thing you'll hear about from all the fanboys who are pumping this movie up, or all great critics who have talked this movie up, is about the airport fight scene. The airport fight scene is literally...
it's fucking amazing.
I cannot disagree with them wholeheartedly about how fucking amazing... everybody who's saying the airport fight scene is fucking amazing, they are definitely know what they're talking about. It is so fucking good.
Everything you want. It is all of your wet fucking dreams happening right there in front of you. One hero fights another hero, fights another hero, switches to another hero, switches to another hero.
Spider-Man's quips the entire time. Spider-Man
is really fucking funny. I think the big surprise for me in terms of comedy in this movie was the relationship between Bucky and Falcon. Right? Like, the relationship between Bucky and Falcon is awesome. No. Yeah, soft spoiler. That's leaning toward not a soft spoiler, but It's very, very entertaining. And there's not a lot of it. There's just a little bit of it, but just a little bit is perfect. No, genuinely, I think the movie is phenomenal. You absolutely have to see it. It is one of the, like, now the big question is it better than Winter Soldier? I don't think it's better than Winter Soldier because I think Winter Soldier had a better plot, it had a better villain, and it had, it was more of a surprise. Like, going from First Avenger to Winter Soldier, that shit was a shock. That was diving into an ice bath. You didn't know what the fuck was going on. That opening fight scene where Captain America is just kicking, beating the fuck out of people.
Kicking people off the boat.
Yeah. And he fights George St. Pierre. Like, that shit came out of nowhere. And it blew me away in the theater. So I still think Winter Soldier is a better movie because it did so much more for the universe. It ended on such a high note. It was such a big ending. It was so good.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie, like I said, it just didn't have as much of an ending. The plot wasn't really there. It was very, very simple. I'm not going to say it wasn't there. I'm just going to say it was very straightforward. There were no surprises in it. Now, keep in mind, Winter Soldier is a spy movie, so there's a lot of mystery being unraveled, and I tend to like that. If you don't like that, you probably will like this more than Winter Soldier, but they're so close. I think, again, it comes down to just, like, what kind of movie do you like to watch? I like a movie that surprises me. I like a movie with a good plot. I like a movie with a good villain. Like, that's what I tend to look for. This one didn't really have that, so it just kind of drops a little bit lower. But good God, everything else was near perfect. CG's a little sketchy at times, but not terrible. Mm. But, no, man, fuck. Like, I mean, they go a lot of different places. Black Panther is fucking standout. My wife,
he's great.
When I told my wife, she goes, "Oh, who's that character?" And I said, "Black Panther." And she's like, she just kind of snorts under her breath, like, "Fucking Black Panther? Is he a black guy?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she's like, "That's even worse." And I'm like, "Okay, just relax." I start explaining to her that he's like the Prince of Wakanda. His name is T'Challa. And she's like, "It sounds awful." I'm like, "Just wait, just wait, just wait. It's going to be really good." Her favorite character out of that movie. She was like, he's so fucking cool.
Every scene...
And the character is so good.
Every scene Black Panther is in, he steals. And I mean that as him as T'Challa. Because they treat the character with such reverence. When they figure out who it actually is.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And that's the most heavy-hittingest thing, is that the guy shows up, they figure out exactly who is, like...
He's a great, great actor, too.
And, yeah, and he's the guy who did, he was the guy who played in 42.
Yeah.
So, very talented actor. And then, yeah, he was awesome in the movie.
Oh, man, like, Black Panther's part in the movie is strong. And it's not just a bit part, it's not Aquaman blue stealing the camera. He plays a serious role in the movie, and that serious role in the movie sets up his movie so well. Uh-huh. I think when we see the trailer for the Black Panther movie, people are going to be fired the fuck up, because that shit was cool in that movie,
hey,
man.
Hey, speaking of trailers, the Rogue One trailer in the movie theater is 10 times better.
Okay, so, while we were watching the trailers, we were putting on our 3D glasses, and the Rogue One trailer comes on, and it's in 3D, and I turned to Matt, and I was like, "That was 10 times better in 3D," and you're like, "Yeah." It was surprising, because there was one other trailer that I think we saw in 3D where we were like, "That also looked really good."
Doctor Strange.
Holy shit, dude.
The four trailers we saw was a weird movie that I didn't see. The Shark trailer.
The Shark trailer, yeah.
In 3D, we were like...
Lady on a rock with a shark swimming around her, yeah.
And then so we get those two low-hanging, like, terrible movies, and I'm just like, "All right, whatever." And then we get... the fucking Rogue One trailer. And Doctor Strange. I was like, "Huh, those were a lot better in the theater."
So, the Rogue One trailer looked really, really good in 3D. Like, almost as if it was shot in 3D. It added a lot of coolness to a lot of the combat sequences where we're seeing, like, the AT-ATs on the planet and stuff. Really, really cool. Yeah. So, like, when we were watching that, I was like, "Oh, shit." But Doctor Strange in 3D, I want you guys to picture all of those psychedelic moments from the Doctor Strange trailer.
And just remember
those Inception moments, and just remember them in your head, and then picture it, like, in 3D, they hit so much harder. Like, throwing depth into that shit, like, when Mads Mikkelsen walks into the room, and he, like, waves his hand over, and the room starts curling in on itself, and there's all the kaleidoscope colors.
Or the falling scene.
Where he's falling from, like, the different, like, bendy dimensions. Like, holy dude, that looked so good in 3D. It so did. Like, I'm really fired up for those movies.
And like, I'm over the I Rebel line in the Rogue One trailer, and it let me enjoy the trailer so much more. And I get it. I'm used to the delivery now. It's not killing you anymore. It's not killing me anymore. So I saw it in the movie theater again, and I saw the Rogue One trailer again, and I was like, this trailer actually is really good. It was so good.
It was really good. So, Captain America Civil War, I mean, again, like, we don't want to give a lot away to you guys. This is kind of the soft spoiler or no spoiler type review. It's really good. You absolutely should see it. It's a top five
MCU movie.
It is absolutely top five.
It'll be in someone's top five. It's probably my fourth favorite movie. Because I do really love Ant-Man. I think my love for Ant-Man is growing more and more as I watch clips again online. And I don't know why I love the movie so much, but I just really do love Ant-Man. And I put it up there right below the Avengers, because it's like Winter Soldier, Avengers, Ant-Man, and this one are tied.
Yeah, for me, it's still Avengers, Winter Soldier. Because, like, for me, Avengers was the movie that should never have happened. They said it could never happen.
It was such a good movie.
Like, there's almost nothing bad I can say about that movie.
And for me, being not a comic book reader, I never had the fanboy shock of being like, oh, I never thought this would happen. For me, I was like, oh, they're going to make it. So, this obviously is happening.
If somebody goes like, oh, Winter Soldier's the best, I'm just like, dude, that's fucking fair. Like, for me, it goes Avengers, Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy, the first Iron Man, and probably Civil War and the first Iron Man I would flip between, but I still think Guardians of the Galaxy was better than Civil War.
I think Guardians of the Galaxy is my fifth, and I think the original Iron Man is my sixth.
Okay.
I would put there, but I don't know what Ant-Man hit for me, but it fucking hit home on all cylinders. I fucking love that movie.
I loved Ant-Man. I thought Ant-Man was really good. I don't think Ant-Man had the impact that I would have wanted it to have. And I think that Civil War is kind of in that same boat, where it didn't quite have the impact I wanted out of it. There was great stuff in there. And like I said, the fight scenes and some of the shit that happens in the fight, brutal. Brutal fights, man. Like I said, it escalates. And when it escalates, you're like, holy shit, this is getting on. And the way that the characters react is so good. The only one who feels really out of character is Captain America. And it's because of the fact that he is Team Friendship. And Team Friendship means Team No Logic.
Yeah.
It's just, well, whatever. We're ride or die till the end.
Yeah. He's Vin Diesel.
Right. Sometimes. And that's all it really comes down to, right? Like, and Tony Stark is Team Logic, and yep. no matter how you want to argue that he's not Team Logic, listen, like, anyways, watch it for yourself, go in, pick a team, you might switch, just be ready for that shit. And like I said, what I loved about it was, you could totally see both sides worked. This could have just as easily been Iron Man 4. As opposed to Captain America 3, because they're so prominent in it, and they both have such good character moments in it, that, yeah, man, I buy it. I buy it whole heart. I think we got way more Captain America in Winter Soldier, and I thought we got a lot better stuff out of him in Winter Soldier. In this one, he just seems very obstinate, and he just doesn't really, like you said, like, a lot of the decisions that he makes are just very odd. You don't really understand why the fuck he's doing what he's doing. And that's what really ends up being confusing for that character. But no, I think in general, it is a really good movie. It's absolutely worth seeing. It absolutely destroys Batman v Superman on every single level.
It's not the smartest person in the known universe creating a spear and three fucking gas grenades out of 2 tons of, like, nuclear fucking waste.
He's not the smartest person in the known universe, except for when he needs to be, and then he will be.
It has...
You know, because I can beat everyone, because I'm smart. I'm a detective. That has been Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Maddie.
Have a good one.
Peace.